We're going to still be talking about Moses, or at least one incident in Moses' life. Specifically, we're going to be talking, though, about what happened in Exodus 32, verses 1 through 10. And that, of course, was the golden calf incident. I want to talk today about the theological significance of some of the events that happened there. But also, I'm doing this because I've realized that it used to be my practice every time in fact, it became excessive after a while. Every time that Christmas and Easter rolled around, I would teach on the subject of why we don't observe holy days as a particular congregation and talk a little about the history of those particular events. We talk about the history of how Christmas developed amongst Christians and Easter and so on, and basically talk about why we don't observe the church calendar and the rule of practice for our worship, what we would call the regulative principle of worship, which adheres to the idea that if it's not in Scripture, we don't do it. We try to stick to a simple and biblical format for our practice rather than following the traditions of the church. Now, I've taught several times on Christmas. I don't think I've ever specifically addressed Easter. I'm going to be doing that. I'm also going to be talking about some of the history of American Christian practice. Most American Christians today don't know this, but the majority of denominations that came out of the Reformation, Protestant denominations that came specifically out of the Reformation, Congregationalists, Baptists, Presbyterians, did not, within the United States and within Scotland and Great Britain, did not celebrate or did not observe the church calendar. They did not celebrate Easter. They did not celebrate Christmas. So I'm going to read some of the declarations that were made, particularly by Presbyterians. Some of them are amazing, considering these were entire denominations, speaking as recently as 1970. How many of you know, for instance, AARP? ARP. Anybody heard of it? Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, one of the larger conservative Presbyterian denominations. When they were formed in the 1970s, their constitution explicitly said, following the Westminster Directory of the 1600s, that they were not going to observe Christian holy days. Now, the majority of ARP congregations do actually do that, so changes can happen very quickly. But anyway, let's get back to the Bible. If you'll turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 32. Exodus 32. We're going to be reading about the golden calf incident. Now, this takes place, obviously, after Moses has gotten to Sinai. Not Sinai, but Sinai. With the people of God. And specifically, he has gone up on the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the law of God, and the other associated laws. Now, the law of God, we would divide historically into three different categories. First, there's the moral law. Okay. Now, the moral law is summarized in the Ten Commandments. Those commandments were written by the finger of God. We would say that those laws are eternal. They're binding on all of us. There's never going to be a time, for instance, when adultery is acceptable. There's never going to be a time when murder is acceptable. In heaven especially, you know, nobody will blaspheme. Nobody will break any of those commandments. Those Ten Commandments are an expression of the holy will of God that is forever binding on the consciences of both the regenerate and the unregenerate. Even though the unregenerate, of course, do not follow those instructions, they are still bound by them. Okay? They should not murder. They should not steal. They should not lie. They should not blaspheme the name of God. They should not create false images, for instance. There is never going to be a time in history, in the history of history, before history, when that was an acceptable practice. Now, that's the moral law. And we would say that those laws were written upon the heart of man, okay? Our conscience convicts us when we steal. Our conscience convicts us when we murder. These are not laws made up simply by men and legislatures. These are laws that were written on our hearts. Now, when we fell, of course, and entered into rebellion, the image of God was cracked within us. We still have the pricking of the conscience, but our rebellion enables us to hop over that particular impediment and still break the laws of God. Now, that's the moral law. Then there were two other classes of law that we recognize. The first is the civil law, okay, the civil laws given to Israel, a body of instructions for them as a people. Now, we would say these are applications of the moral law to a particular nation in a particular time, to wit, the theocracy of Israel, which, of course, ended with the destruction of that nation by the Romans in 70 AD. Those would be those instructions, for instance, about not allowing your ox to gore your neighbor and what to do in that case, or your ox to eat the produce of your neighbor's field. What's acceptable if somebody breaks into your home? And there we see God taking himself, the moral law, and applying it to a particular nation, creating those particular laws. Now, in the crafting of our own laws, our own civil laws, we should still be following that general rule. We should take the moral law and apply it to our own nation. So, for instance, let me give you an application of the civil law applied to Israel. What shape were roofs at that time? Does anybody know?
Yeah.
They were flat. Okay, you didn't have snow or much snow, so you didn't have to worry about it accumulating. So you didn't need the peaked roofs that allow it to slide off. So they would have a flat roof, and they would use that flat roof for things, for instance, for drying flax and other crops during the planting season and so on. But one of the concerns was that there'd be a parapet around the edge of the roof. Why? So people don't fall off. You don't want to be liable for the negligent homicide of one of your neighbors. You know, you don't want to be guilty of causing his death by your poor construction of your own home. So there's a rule that there should be a parapet around the edge of the home. Well, we don't have flat roofs anymore. But if there's a, and there's a question from Doug. Yes? Okay, sometimes yes. The building man is going to tell me we sometimes do. Right, okay, so, you know, there should be, obviously, I was going to make an application to more basic building codes, for instance, that in building your building, for instance, they didn't have electricity, but we do have electricity, so we need to take pains to make sure that, for instance, wires are not exposed. I was hearing about some of the shoddy building practices, unfortunately, followed by contractors employed by the United States government in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, so that people have actually been killed in the shower when they've had short circuits. That kind of thing is, of course, telling wives that when their husbands are about to deploy is probably not the greatest example I could have used, and I'll smack myself later. But in any event, but that kind of thing is rightly against the law, okay? We should not be culpable for the death of our neighbors because of our own bad building practices if we cut corners and so on. That's an application of the moral law to our own civil codes. There are more basic examples. Now, we, unfortunately, as a nation, are going through the process of upending that and turning all of God's laws on issues like adultery. For instance, the Seventh Commandment is utterly eviscerated in our laws these days. Adultery is okay. And the Sixth Commandment, we're gradually making inroads on that in areas like euthanasia and abortion and so on. So we're gradually turning God's laws on its head, but it should be that which guides our society. In order to be qualified as a just society, we have to pay attention to God's law. The degree to which we do that will define whether or not we are just or not. But moving on, then there's that final category of law, the ceremonial law. Now, these were the laws that they were to follow in their worship practices. Now, this is a huge bulk of laws, but all of them ultimately pointed towards Jesus the Messiah and his coming. You have, for instance, that immense example of that in the Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement ritual, okay, where they would take, the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies, he would take the sins of Israel, the whole people of Israel, and apply them to the head of the scapegoat ritually and go through that that process by which we see the imputation of sin to a vicarious sacrifice. And that was an important, obviously, symbol of what Christ would be doing. So the ceremonial laws pointed towards Christ, and Christ fulfilled those laws. Okay, he was the fullness that they were all pointing towards. If you don't believe that, read Hebrews, particularly chapters like 9 and 10, where it speaks of Christ's sacrifice as the real sacrifice that took away sin. We know before that, of course, that they would sacrifice goats and bulls, but the author of Hebrews makes the point that goats, the blood of goats and bulls can't take away sins. We need a perfect sacrifice. So all of the ceremonial law pointed towards Jesus. And as we'll see, that's one of the reasons why adherence to God's ceremonial laws in their worship practices was so critical. Because those laws pointed towards Jesus Christ. If they made their own invented worship practices, would they point towards Jesus? Would they be symbolic of Jesus? No. If they adopted the pagan practices of their neighbors, even if they were really popular, would those pagan practices point towards Christ and be sufficient to build people up in the faith that alone saves? The answer is no. When they imported, therefore, pagan practices, or they invented their own worship, they were actually deviating from God's plan of redemption. And while they may be excited or enjoy those practices, they were no part of God's plan of redemption. And, of course, his ceremonial law was intended to put people in mind of things like their own sin, their own blood guilt, their own need of atonement, their own need of faith, and so on. And when they deviated from God's instructions, they were deviating from those rules that would point them towards that. All right, so that was the ceremonial law. Those laws were fulfilled by Jesus Christ, therefore they are no longer in place. That would include, for instance, the dietary restrictions. They did not eat certain kinds of food, and they did not eat them because they were being set apart as a holy people from their neighbors. Those dietary restrictions, of course, were abrogated, and we see that happening stunningly, for instance, when the image of the when Peter has that vision of the sheep descending, "Arise, Peter, kill and eat." And of course he says, "No, Lord, I've never eaten any unclean thing." But the division, the walls of division that have been placed around them, dividing them from the Gentiles, are being taken down as the gospel now spreads to all of the nations, and the ceremonial laws are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. All right, let's go to then Exodus 32, if you would. Israel's gotten to Sinai. Moses has gone up onto the mountain. He has already received the tablets. Israel, this is an important point to make, has already covenanted with God. Okay, the tribes have been sprinkled with blood. Pillars symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel have sprinkled. They've all covenanted, voluntarily stepped forward and said, "Yes, we will enter into a covenant with God. We will observe His laws and His strictures." They had already been doing that. They had already received instructions, for instance, like, "You will not make an image." Okay, and we're going to see, unfortunately, that they did not necessarily follow that law. Now, Moses, though, has gone up to the top of the mountain. What did the top of the mountain at this point look like? Thick cloud, flashing thunder. It looked like a furnace up there. Moses enters into it. How long is he up there? 40 days. Is that longer than a month? Yeah. People have no, I mean, they can't call him on the cell phone. This is long before that kind of thing. So they're beginning to suspect he has died, gone, you know, he's entered into the glory cloud, and he's been utterly consumed, and now what are we going to do? Our mediator is gone. The one who spoke with God for us is gone. Well, it's time to kind of hop back. That's okay. We'll just go back to sensual religion. We'll just go back to symbolic religion. We don't have somebody to pass on to us the revelation of God, the word of God, this angry God who's on the top of the mountain. So we'll go back to the worship by types, okay, and shadows and symbolism that the Egyptians indulged in when they practiced their worship. We'll just follow the pattern that was set for us in Egypt. We'll go back to that particular pattern. And so we take up the story in Exodus 32, 1. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, there's a minor understatement, over a month, the people gathered together to Aaron. Now, who is Aaron? Brother of Moses. What position does he occupy at this point? He is the priest, okay, the high priest, in essence, of Israelite religion. "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, now what should Aaron's reply have been? "No way, are you joking? More than my life is worth." You know, he should have pointed them towards, "Look, you see the top of the mountain there? There's the God you covenanted with and said you would not do this kind of thing. He's right up there, thundering, okay? We're going to break his law in his very presence? Are you insane? Are you utterly evil and self-destructive?" But he doesn't say that. He looks around at the people, and he looks at, obviously, these things don't happen all at once. 10 days pass, people start grumbling. Another 10 days pass, grumbling gets more intense. Another 10 days pass. By that time, the people are in an uproar, whispers going back and forth through the camp. "Where's Moses? What are we going to do now?" Another 10 days pass. Self-appointed leaders have been raised up to represent the assembly. We need to do something. All right? So, this is what's happened. The atmosphere is ugly, and at this point, it's a time for courage, and instead he bounces back to what we all would prefer to do, which is man-please. Okay? Man-pleasing is usually the great cause of apostasy in religion. We see people upset. We see people not getting what they want. And we say, "I want them to be happy. I'll give them what they want. I'll make the changes that I shouldn't make in order to make the people happy." And Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Now, this is a very important point. He's not introducing them to a new God. I want you to understand that, okay? There's going to be times when he specifically says, this is Yahweh. This is an image of Yahweh. And I want you to understand that the people aren't naive enough to think, oh, the golden image over there is literally Yahweh. No, it's a symbol of Yahweh, okay? It's a material representation of Yahweh in their midst, okay? What commandment are they breaking, therefore? Second commandment. They've made an image of God. All right? Now, let me ask you a question. Does God look like a calf? Does he tell us anywhere in his revelation, I am like a calf, all covered in gold, and, you know, does he say anything like that? Mm-mm. Even in the highly symbolic language of the Psalms, we don't find, where did they get this calf imagery from then? The Egyptians. The calf and the bull were symbols of power, symbols of fertility, okay? We still, you know, what's a bull market? It's a good market, right? A market that's charging ahead and so on. It's a powerful market, a surging market. It's a market we're never going to see probably in our life. Just kidding. Moving on. But it's a symbol of power, is it not? And so we have this powerful image, youth, fertility, robustness. You know, we're going to charge ahead to the promised land using an image that the people would have been familiar with. And he creates it for them and he says, this is an image of your God that delivered you. Pins the image to a specific redemptive event that delivered you out of Egypt. And how does God identify himself in the preface to the Ten Commandments to his people? I'm the God who delivered you out of Egypt. So the people would have said, aha, I know who this God is. All right, Aaron is not introducing them to a new God. All right. So when Aaron saw it, he put an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. So, now, we have another thing occurring. First, we had the false image. God said, you shall not make any images in the second commandment. The second thing that happens is, now we're going to have a new form of worship. God did not say, make an altar in front of a calf. Okay? And then Aaron introduces something also that would have been very familiar to the people. A holy day, a festival day, a day set aside not for work, okay, not for the normal routines of men, but for religious offerings, for religious celebration. All right? A holy day, the first uncommanded holy day of God's people occurs right here. Golden Calf Redemption Day. All right? He invents this, and he says, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Okay? That is important. In the word Lord, whenever you see Lord in uppercase, what word is usually being used in the Hebrew? Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton. Tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh. All right? We've created an image of Yahweh. Now we're going to create a day for worshiping Yahweh. Yahweh should be so pleased, right? It's a day for him! A day where they're celebrating his redemption. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, don't you just love it when your kids break your china into little pieces and then arrange the bits into a little image and design for you and hand it to you? No. Why not? Why wouldn't you be pleased with that? Because their act of homage to you was an act of will on their part that involved breaking specifically your commandments. And this is what the people are doing with God. All right. So, then they arose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings. Here we have sacrifices. And brought peace offerings. Now, interestingly enough, are burnt offerings and peace offerings part of Israel's worship given to them by God? Yes, they are. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Okay, here's where paganism really gets its saying. The celebrations of God's law, the celebrations, I should say, that are included in the ceremonial law are celebrations that are sober, celebrations that are reverent, celebrations that have an element of joy to them, but not like the pagan celebrations. The pagan celebrations of Egypt, the pagan celebrations of Canaan, the pagan celebrations of the pagan peoples in the first century, in Corinth, for instance. They usually involved, for instance, ritual prostitution. They usually involved, to symbolize fertility, for instance, and things like that. They usually involved drunkenness. drinking to the state of inebriation, a state of ecstasy and happiness, all right? Unrestrained, unbridled sensuality. No poor place for revelation. Now, I want you to note something else. Christianity, when it goes to seed, follows exactly the same pattern. When it turns the wrong corner, revelation gets dumped, sensuality and excitement are elevated. Okay, that's where, unfortunately, we see American evangelicalism at this point in time. Revelation, its stock sinks lower and lower and lower, but excitement and sensuality rise higher and higher and higher. So, okay. They rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And rose up to play is a word that's pregnant with me. I don't think I need to think New York, St. Patty's Day, and you get the idea of how they're celebrating this particular religious feast as well. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people, stubborn.'" Now, therefore, an animal is stiff-necked if you can't turn it. All right. If you were plowing with an ox that was stiff-necked, it would mean you could not, you'd get one furrow, and then the ox would be, "I'm going to continue to walk in this direction." "No, no, we need to start the next one." "No, I'm going this way." Or a donkey, you could not turn out of the way. It was stiff-necked, failing to obey the commands of its master. That's the image that's being set before these people. "Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation." And of course, at that point, Moses intercedes for the people. Now, God could have destroyed the people utterly. They had broken his covenant. They had entered into it freely. They deserved nothing but wrath at this point in time and judgment. All right, the covenant was broken. How does Moses symbolize that the covenant has been broken, that they had broken the covenant with Yahweh? He smashes their copies of the covenant, the Ten Commandment tablets. He just smashes them on the ground to show you have shattered the covenant with Yahweh symbolically. So it wasn't simply an act of empty anger. He was showing them what they had done. They'd broken the covenant with Yahweh, the very Yahweh they claimed to be worshiping. At that point in time, they were, in fact, dishonoring. So he has to intercede for them. God could have destroyed them. He doesn't, in order to set before us our need of a mediator. Because have you and I broken the covenant with Yahweh as well? This very day, okay, we have broken God's law. And therefore, we need an intercessor. Who intercedes for us? Who does Moses point towards? Christ, okay? None of us is saved by the keeping of the law. We need a mediator. We need an intercessor, all right? So, what do we learn from this pagan celebration of Deliverance Day? Well, one of the first things we learn is that men's heart are, as Calvin put it, as prone to idolatry as dry wood is to fire. I'm sorry, I think that's actually Thomas Watson. As long as you understand, it's not Andy Webb. This is not original to me. Moses only has to be gone for a little while before the Israelites begin breaking God's explicit commandments and creating new ways of worshiping him, despite the fact that he is visibly present on top of the mountain. Okay, what was true then, though, is true now. We are just as prone to devise new ways of worshiping God, new ceremonies, new days that we desperately want to worship. And we always think that God is going to be pleased with them. I know what God likes. God likes what I like. All right. That's our feeling, because honestly, God's just me writ large. Right. So that's what they do. Paul, okay, notes that this is part of the human heart, and that God's people are going to be prone to this. He says in 1 Corinthians 10:6, "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." So, and he recounts all of the bad things, so to speak, seriatim, that God's people did in the wilderness, point by point by point. Now, Easter, I want to zoom ahead to the practice of Easter. Incidentally, what did all of this change in the New Testament? Did God say, all right, in the Old Testament, I told you how to worship. But in the New Testament, I'm giving you legislative power. All authority and power has been given to you. It's been handed into the hands of the church. You go out and you tell men, you command them to worship the way you see fit. Give them commandments that you think will help them to get closer to me. No. In fact, one of the things that he brings to the Pharisees is the fact that they were teaching the traditions of men, and understand these are long established traditions. How long has the United States been around? Somebody tell me. 200 years, right? Okay, a little more, 1976, obviously. I came over during the bicentennial. It was a great time to be an English kid getting off the boat. But anyway, America's been around for about a little over 200 years, 200 years and change. Well, these commandments that the Pharisees were handing on had been handed on to them by rabbi after rabbi after rabbi for 400 years. Well-established traditions. Okay, coming almost from the time when Israel returned to the promised land. They'd been hearing these things, you know, okay, wash before you eat. It's a symbolic cleansing of your hands that washes away the impurity and corruption that you may have picked up during the day so you will not imbibe sin and become unclean and thus unable to worship, things like that. And Jesus is saying, you teach the commandments of men as though they were the commandments of God. Your lips are full of God words, but your hearts are far from me. You teach men inventions. You teach men innovations. And understand this, antiquity does not make a lie true. All right? Antiquity does not make a sin good. So it doesn't matter if we've been disobeying the Lord for 1 year or 500 years. Now, men don't understand this. They figure that an innovation developed by the church 1,000 years ago is therefore established and good. It's the tradition of the fathers. But if we come up with an innovation developed by the church 15 minutes ago, oh, this is a new innovation. This is bad. This is bad. Your praise band is evil and corrupt, but my handbell choir is wonderful because we've been doing that for 300 years now. This is a tradition of my grandma. And if grandma did it, it's got to be good, right? Remember the cookies? Anyway, that's not the case, brothers and sisters. If we're disobeying God's law, it doesn't matter how long we've been disobeying God's law. It doesn't matter that your fathers disobeyed God's law, your grandfather, your great-grandfather. They were still sinning when they did it. That's the thing that we need to remember. All right, Easter. On what day did Paul observe Easter? Doo-doo. Joy? Thank you, hon. No. I know what you're saying. On what day did Paul celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ? 52 times a year, every Sunday. Very good. All right, I don't want a theologically nuanced answer. I want a literal answer. Let me make this clear. When did Paul celebrate Easter? Never. Okay, very good. The apostolic church never did. Where do we get the name Easter? You're not going to find it in the Bible. What? Ishtar is one answer. Eostra. It comes to us, actually, the Venerable Bede preserves the tradition. When was the Bede writing, incidentally? During what is sometimes called the Dark Ages. He is one of Britain's greatest ecclesiastical historians. Okay, a man who preserved, so to speak, a record of the beginnings of the British Church, some of the great saints and men who established the faith in amongst the English speaking people. We have a preservation of that knowledge from the Bede. He says this, okay, in his writings under the English months. In olden time, the English people, for it did seem fitting to me that I should speak of other people's observance of the year and yet be silent about my own nations, calculated their months according to the course of the moon. Hence, after the manner of the Greeks and the Romans, the months take their name from the moon, and the moon is called Mona, and the month Monath. Interesting. So now you know where we get the word month as well. The first month, which the Latins call the January, is Juli. February is called Salmonath. March, Heramonath. April, Eostermonath. Are you getting it? Thrillamicki, June. Litha, July. Letha, August. Weodmonath, September. Haligmonath, October. Winter filleth November, blood moneth December, and Juli, the same name by which January is called. Nor is it irrelevant if we take the time to translate the names of the other month. Heramonath is named for their goddess Haritha, to whom they sacrificed at this time. Eostermonath has a name which is now translated Paschal month, and which was once called after a goddess of theirs named Eostra, in whose honor feasts were celebrated in that month. Now they designate the Paschal season by her name, calling the joys of the new rite by the time-honored name of old observance. What do we call that, incidentally, when we take time-honored old observances and we incorporate them into our religion? Syncretism. Three-letter. Thrill Mickey, and so on. Now, we get the name Easter from that Eostermonath. We take it directly from the name of a pagan festival in which the goddess was celebrated. Easter has no origin in Christian tradition. It has its origin in pagan tradition. Now, it was celebrated by the church at least from the 300s. We know that from ecclesiastical records. Prior to that, though, these were feast days that were gradually being invented and added to the calendar. Okay, not just Easter, obviously, but a wealth of feast days, and then saints' days, until by the time the Reformation came along, the reformers were complaining, there's scarcely a day you can set aside for work. We have so many saints' days, so many feast days. We have the church calendar is so full that a man could spend his entire day, his entire year, going to church. But the commandment of God says, how many days you shall labor? 6 days you shall labor, and the seventh, okay, is a day of rest, a day given to the Lord. They had broken that cycle by introducing feast day after feast day. And one of the things that we see is as feast days, uncommanded feast days are introduced, the reverence that men have for the Lord's day gradually begins to be denuded. Men will come to church on Christmas and Easter who never, ever sanctify the Lord's day in their hearts and think that they're doing God a service. They do what God has not commanded and pat themselves on the back, and then ignore what he has commanded. I grew up in a household that did that, that went to church on C&E, Christmas and Easter. Okay, those were the big days. Now, as soon as Easter is introduced, a fight breaks out throughout the church over it that goes on for over 100 years. What day will we celebrate this day? Because it wasn't set in the Bible. The Eastern Church wanted to celebrate it around the time of the Passover. But the Western Church wanted to celebrate it on a particular Sunday, and so they begin bickering back and forth. And one of the church historians, a man by the name of Socrates, no relation to the original Greek Socrates, of course, writes attempting to, about 480, attempting to interrupt this bickering that's going back and forth. He says, you know, you're having an argument, okay, over something that men shouldn't be arguing about, because it's no part of biblical instruction. He says this, nay, the apostle hath in plain words forbidden it, where he abrogates circumcision and exhorts us not to contend about feasts and holy days. For writing to the Galatians, he admonishes them not to observe days and months and times and years, and now unto the Colossians he is as plain as may be, declaring that the observance of such things was but a shadow. Neither the apostles nor the evangelists have enjoined on Christians the observance of Easter, but have left the remembrance of it to the free choice and discretion of those who have been benefited by such days. I would argue with that. But men keep holy days because thereon they enjoy rest from toil and labor. Therefore it comes to pass that in every place they do celebrate of their own accord the remembrance of the Lord's passion, but neither our Savior nor his apostles have anywhere commanded us to observe it. Now, Socrates, however, is while he's saying, okay, that the apostles didn't command us to observe this, the Lord didn't command us to observe it, it's nowhere commanded, and he's saying, so why are you arguing about it? As though you're right or you're right. He is already coming to a position, though, that was to give away the entire store, so to speak. What he is saying is that the church has a right to institute ceremonies and traditions. If we are going to observe Christmas and Easter, we need to have that position, all right? If we are going to observe uncommanded days and come up with things and tell people we're going to do this now, that God hasn't commanded us, our position on worship needs to be that God has given us legislative power and has given us the ability to teach men what we think will profit them, not what he has instructed us. Now, the Anglican Church expressly says this in the 39 Articles. It says, the Church hath power to decree rites and ceremonies. But the Reformers denied this. They said, no, who's the only one who has a right to bind men's consciences and tell them how to worship him? God. Now, this is important. Just as the rites and ceremonies, okay, that would the Israelite people created for themselves didn't point forward to Jesus Christ. Remember this, the rites and ceremonies and institutions and so on that we create for ourselves, although we kid ourselves that they do, do not point backwards to him. All right? He has given us his commandments to point to him and to point forward to his coming again. All right, what I want you to do now is to take up your hymnal. We're not going to sing a hymn, I promise. Even though my wife is here, so I could be reasonably expected to carry a tune. We're not going to do it. What we are going to do instead is turn in the back of our hymnals to our conveniently printed Westminster Confession of Faith. On page 860 specifically, of Religious Worship and the Sabbath Day. And there we read in section 1, the light of nature showeth that there is a God who hath lordship and sovereignty over all. I'm reading on page 860, chapter 21, section 1. It's right here on the page if you're looking for it. The light of nature showeth that there is a God who hath lordship and sovereignty over all, is good and doth good unto all, and is therefore to be feared, loved, praised, called upon, trusted in, and served with all the heart and with all the soul and with all the might. But the acceptable way of worshiping the true God is instituted by himself, and so limited by his own revealed will. And where has he revealed his will? In the Bible, right? Not to Joseph Smith, all right? He's revealed it in his word, the Bible. And so limited by his own revealed will that he may not be worshipped according to the imaginations and devices of men or the suggestions of Satan under any visible representation or any other way not prescribed in the Holy Scripture. Now, this is what the Westminster Confession stated, and that was the confession of the Puritans. But I want you to understand, it wasn't just Presbyterians who held to that principle, the regulative principle. The English Baptists did. And when they came to the United States, the American Baptists did. The Congregationalists did. Joy? Okay, I've lost my train. Go ahead. Sorry. Oh, Ruth. Yeah, no, you're right. Right. Yeah, hey, I want you to understand, I'm explaining why we do things. I'm not telling you you can't celebrate Christmas in your own home, give your kids Christmas presents, have a tree. I'm not invading your home and saying, if somebody starts worshiping, you know, Satan in their home and sacrificing goats and so on, I'm going to get upset. I'll be frank with you. But you want to observe Secretary's Day, you go ahead and do so. You want to observe July 4th, you go ahead and do so, unless you're English. If you want to go, and I do, that's a bizarre thing. If you want to go ahead and observe whatever American Hallmark holiday you want to observe in your own home, you do it. You want to wear a green hat on St. Paddy's Day, go ahead. You get drunk, I've got a problem. But aside from that, it's okay. We're talking about what the church can do and what the church can teach its disciples to do. We're not going to observe Secretary's Day. I'm sorry. I love secretaries, you know, good job, but I'm not going to observe it as a day because it's uncommanded. So in any event, this was the practice of the Americans coming out of the Reformation until the end of the 19th century. Now, it gradually began to be, without any theological change, brought into the American church. And so many churches had to make declarations saying, in essence, stop it. I've got, here's one. This is from the PCUS, the Southern Presbyterians, from 1899. Okay? The General Assembly passed this. There is no warrant in Scripture for the observance of Christmas and Easter as holy days. Rather, the contrary. See Galatians 4, 9 through 11, Colossians 2, 16 through 21. And such observance is contrary to the principles of the Reformed faith, conducive to will worship, and not in harmony with the simplicity of the gospel of Jesus Christ. They forbade it in 1899. And yet here, 100 years later, you will find that 80% of Presbyterians observe these holy days. And also, one of the things that you will find is that once the calendar gets reinstituted, Katie barred the door because the entire calendar begins to flood back in, and I'm seeing that. It used to be Christmas, then we got Easter back, then we got Maundy Thursday, then Good Friday, then, you know, I'm seeing now Protestant churches celebrating Advent and Lent, which makes no sense, all right? It's only a matter of time before we get Saints' Days back. Ah, it's Michaelmas, and, you know, where does it end, all right? In any event, that is generally what happens. I want to leave at least a minute or two for questions that may be pressing upon you. Any questions? Any questions? E-O-S-T-R-E. Venerable B-E-D-E. Yeah. Any others? Any others? Any others? Yes. Yes, the Methodists and the Episcopalians do observe holy days, but one of the interesting things to note is that's because their conception of what is allowable in worship is slightly different. Methodists, Episcopalians, Lutherans, and of course Roman Catholics all believe that the church has the right to decree, that they have legislative power, that they have the right to decree worship ceremonies, rites, and rituals, to invent things, as long as it's the power of the church and not individuals that are doing this. They are allowed to do it. So the Methodists do follow the that. Yes. Days of Thanksgiving and fasting upon special occasions. In other words, if something happens providentially, if we have a great national deliverance, that's something we should offer Thanksgiving for. If we are in the middle of a great national woe, that's something that we should be fasting. After 9/11, for instance, the church that I was attending in Hatboro had a day of fast, prayer and fasting, which I think was absolutely proper at that point in time. Yes? Following providence rather than, okay, now we're going to have 9/11 day for the rest of, you know, our lives and the lives of the children following us. All right? That's not the...